I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and this is Podcast Playlist. Picture this. It's 2007. We're in the New Mexico desert, and 40 kids have just been dropped off in an abandoned mining town to fend for themselves with no way to contact their parents. It's not a case of mass child abduction. These kids were there willingly. Well, kind of, but we'll get to that. This was the premise of the reality TV show Kid Nation on CBS, and the idea was that the kids would spend 40 days in the desert and build their own society from scratch. And when I say from scratch, they were not provided beds when they arrived. There was only a single outhouse for all 40 of them. And if they wanted to have chicken for dinner, they had to kill the chicken themselves. This obviously raises a ton of ethical questions, and the new CBC podcast, Split Screen, Kid Nation, is revisiting the series to try and find some answers. The podcast is hosted by Josh Gwynn, and through interviews with former contestants, producers, and parents, he's trying to piece together how this show actually got made and what impact it had on those kids now that they're all grown up. And Josh is here to tell us about the show and share some of his favorite podcasts. Josh, welcome to Podcast Playlist.
Thank you for having me, Leah.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm so glad that you're here. This series is wild and sent me down several rabbit holes, I will admit. I had never heard of this show, but you saw it when it premiered in 2007. So what was it like to see Kid Nation for the first time at that point in time?
I have a pretty vivid memory of seeing like the trailer on television and thinking to myself, I've never seen a reality show with kids in it before, I don't think.
Welcome to Kid Nation.
No one here knows how to cook.
I'm a beauty queen, I don't do dishes.
The only show where kids will do things all on their own.
And also, like, is this allowed? Can they do this? Like, wow, they really dropped off 40 kids in the middle of the desert in New Mexico. And we're like, YOLO. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah. And I'm wondering how prepared were they for this experience? Did they know what to expect? Were they given any sort of prep? Or what did you learn about that?
That was one of the questions that I had, which was, after watching it, you're like, whose parent sends their kid to do this?
Yeah.
And I spoke to some of the former contestants and I spoke to some of their parents. And what they told me is that they were told that it was a show that was like a summer camp. Like, I have a crush on this person. Like, this is what's the drama at the mess hall. Like, I auditioned for this part in the play. That's the show I think that they thought that they were sending their kids to be on.
It's so bizarre for me to hear, you know, the premise of this show and kind of what these contestants went through. But because it's a reality television show, a lot of it is orchestrated. So how did they do that on this show? Like, how did they create tension? How did they do that for these kids?
A big part of it was casting. So when I spoke to some of the former contestants, I actually was really impressed and shocked with the level of self-awareness that some of them had, like the understanding that someone is going to take that footage later and construct a narrative with it. One of the former contestants I spoke to, he's from Seattle, and at the time he had like the really shaggy hair and he played guitar, and he seemed pretty aware that I play guitar, I'm kind of like a hippie-ish kind of kid. Like, they probably want me to play Peacemaker.
So how do they all look back on this experience now?
It was actually like one of the most surprising things to me, because the experience that the kids had was so varied. Like, and I think that a lot of the differences in how they look back at that time have to do with how their character, air quotes, was edited, you know?
Right.
Because for some of them, it was a really, really negative experience. It was the first time that they realized that like people could hate them. Mm. For others, it's kind of just like a weird thing that they probably mention in those like icebreaker games that you have, where it's like name two truths and a lie. They like did it and then they like never really thought about it again.
Right.
And then for others, it was like a really positive experience where they were able to be without their families and kind of get to know who they were and what their ideas were. And so it was just interesting to find out that all of them had such different experiences.
Mm. You also spoke to the creator, Gan Maynard. What did he have to say about Kid Nation today? Like, how does he look at that creation and that experience?
So one of our producers, Aran, he interviewed Gen, and his big reference point or inspiration was this study that he cited. And he said that it showed that if a parent were present and a kid fell, their reaction would be crying and it would be bigger than if an adult wasn't present. They usually would self-soothe in some sort of way. And he took that to mean that children are a lot more capable of handling themselves and stressful situations more than what adults will give them credit for. I think that's interesting.
Certainly, yes.
But also think that, like, you know, when you think about like university studies, they have to go through like ethical review and be like, there's entire boards that look at how an experiment is constructed. I don't know whether the show would pass an ethics board, you know?
Yeah, and they're not filmed for millions of people to watch year after year on YouTube.
Right.
So do you think he has any regrets about the show?
It seems like he stands by the show. And it seems that he felt as though there were a lot of controversy from people who hadn't even watched the show.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. Okay, I do want to play a bit of the podcast now so people can hear a bit of it. In this clip, we're going to hear from a former contestant on Kid Nation. Her name's Olivia. She was 13 at the time of filming, and her sister Mallory, who was also on the show, was only 8. Here she is talking about the first day on set. Let's give it a listen.
Olivia and Mallory, they take their seat near the middle of the bus. A producer puts a camera and a mic in their face and just starts reeling off questions.
What do you think about where we're going? Or how do you feel right now? Do you miss your parents? You know, all these kind of questions. One of the things we weren't allowed to have was watches. So we actually never knew what time it was. And so I have no idea how long they drove us around on that bus, but they drove us around on the bus for quite a while.
As the bus rolls along the barren New Mexico desert and the crew are tripping over backpacks left in the aisle, one of the producers asks a boy with long hair what he'll miss most about home.
I'm an adult, and I think I'm gonna die out here because there's nothing. It's kinda hard to believe.
The boy's name is Jimmy, and like Mallory, he's only 8 years old. Eventually, the bus stops by a wooden shack. It looks like it's in the middle of nowhere.
There's nothing here. There are 40 of us. There's one building. This is what we're gonna do. And they let us kind of panic for a minute. Like, we kept asking the producers and the adults, hey, is this where we're gonna be? Like, what's going on here? And they would not answer our questions. They just kept telling us, stop talking to us, talk to each other.
A man with spiky black hair wearing a plaid shirt and jeans arrives on the scene. He introduces himself as Kid Nation host Jonathan Karsh. Before Kid Nation, Karsh had been a reality producer for Extreme Makeover Home Edition. He would later go on to develop MTV's Catfish, a reality show where people catch people pretending to be other people online. Jonathan tells the kids that they're going to be spending the next 40 days in an abandoned ghost town just a couple miles down the road.
I was relieved in that moment because I thought, okay, this isn't really where we're going to stay. We're going to go down the road a little bit and there'll be somewhere real for us to stay.
The kids start gathering their belongings. but they're interrupted by loud whirling sounds and dust flying everywhere. Olivia looks up and she sees a helicopter approaching.
When the helicopter landed and these kids came out, he was telling us this is going to be the town council. And we all thought, oh, perfect. They probably told them what we're supposed to be doing.
The producers picked four kids to be the leaders. They're known as the town council, and it's made up of 12-year-old spelling bee champion Anjay, 11-year-old Boy Scout Mike, 10-year-old beauty pageant queen Taylor, and 12-year-old theater kid Laurel.
And then when we started talking to them at first, we realized they had no idea what was going on either.
After meeting the town council, Jonathan tells the kids to load up their belongings onto rickety wooden wagons. They're going to have to hike to their final destination.
The wagons came out and we're in the middle of the desert. I just sat there and thought, what nightmare have we gotten into?
The journey is several miles long, and on screen, it looks totally chaotic. I don't know if you remember that game, Oregon Trail, from the 90s, but it looks like a real-life version of that. They look like they tried to ford the river and their oxen died. The kids have to catch up with a herd of wild goats that are escaping from pens, and the wagon with all their supplies rolls over, and the kids start bickering. One of them, 14-year-old DK, suffers a muscle spasm and falls to the ground, clutching his ankle. Exhausted, but excited, the pioneers finally arrive at their destination.
When we first got to Bonanza City, I really thought that there was going to be someone there to tell us what we were supposed to be doing, and nobody did.
This abandoned ghost town where the kids are going to build their new world, it's 13 miles south of Santa Fe, New Mexico. It's called Bonanza City. It was once a gold rush town established in 1880, but the population plummeted from 2,000 to 200 within just a few years, and it was completely abandoned by the early 1900s. This probably explains why Kid Nation adopts this frontier framing for its young participants. For most of the show, the kids are referred to as pioneers. But Bonanza also has this long history as a filming location. It's been Hollywood's go-to since the 1950s, with more than 130 films and TV shows, including classic westerns like Butch Cassidy and The Sundance Kid, Easy Rider, and Lonesome Dove. Tragically, Bonanza was also the setting of a real-life shooting in 2021 when actor Alec Baldwin fired a prop gun that killed rising cinematographer Helena Hutchins and wounded director Joel Souza. The place is laid out like the letter X, with four unpaved streets lined with wooden buildings. On one side, you have the bunkhouses. On the other side is a half-sheltered kitchen and a small chapel where the town council would hold their meetings.
All the adults kind of looked at us and went silent because they just wanted to get our initial reactions on film. They had intentionally kind of trashed the town a little bit, put random things all over the place, so we had to clean it up a little bit. When we figured out that there was not going to be any sort of beds, that we were basically going to have to spread our sleeping bags out on the floor, we were all pretty surprised. Honestly, a lot of us were still scared and worried about what was going to happen because none of us had really been told the full truth about what the experience was going to be like.
It's not just that the bunks are bad. To use the bathroom, the 40 of them have to share one wooden shack with a wooden seat over a hole in the ground.
There was a line for the outhouse and people like dying to get in, and that was all we had.
While some of the kids settle into their bunks, others are trying to figure out the food situation. And it doesn't take long for an argument to erupt in the kitchen as the kids struggle to make mac and cheese. They don't know that you have to wait for the water to boil first before you put the noodles in because they're kids.
We didn't have cheese. We didn't have refrigeration, so we didn't have cheese. And we only had a wood-burning stove. So it took a very, very long time to cook anything.
To make matters worse, there's not even running water.
If they want water, they have to fill up their buckets from a single water pump on the outskirts of town and carry it all the way back.
The first day was horrible. And honestly, when you look at the show, if you pay attention to the beginning footage, what you see at the start is a lot of footage of Jonathan. A lot more footage than any of the rest of the show. Because we were super cold and miserable that first day. I remember that first night, sleeping a little bit, but really mostly just trying to keep warm and stop crying. And then on top of it, not long after we got into the high desert, a lot of us got altitude sickness. And so I remember that first night just being miserable. It's not really that easy to function when you're kind of worried about your basic survival, you know?
That was Split Screen, Kid Nation, a Vespucci production for CBC. Their team includes Aaron Keller, Thomas Curry, Matt Willis, Alice Boyd, Kate Evans, Willow Smith, and Anna Ashite. It's hosted and co-written by Josh Gwynn, who's with me now. So I have to confess that I was both horrified at the premise of this show and disturbed, but also really wanted to watch it. Like, I was like, let me go on you, if I'm totally honest. And I had to, like, look into myself to think, you know, what is that about me and about us that kind of wants to consume this type of reality television show? I definitely don't think it should be made today, but I was very curious about it. So why do you think, I mean, CBS greenlit this. Why do you think people are drawn to reality shows like this?
I think it's a product of its time. I think that in 2007, media isn't as segmented then as it is now. So you have like network channels like competing and trying to get the most sensational, the craziest. You have shows like Survivor, but you also have shows like Fear Factor, where they're dropping people into boxes full of earthworms and people are eating bull testicles. You have shows like The Swan, where you have a beauty competition and they remove all of the mirrors from the contestants' homes while they go through this beauty competition, where everyone is getting a bunch of plastic surgery that they can't see until the end. And then you have like a semicircle of all of the people's like coaches like clapping when there's a reveal, and the women are looking into a mirror and being like, I'm beautiful. It's dystopian.
It was bad. It was bad. That show
there's
was
another
so
show
bad.
Called Black and White, where you have a white family that they put into blackface, and you have a black family that they put into whiteface, and they quote unquote live the experience of being a different race, even though all of them look ridiculous. None of them look real.
It's just, did that come on?
I don't remember, but I remember it being wild. And so you have this kind of arms race for the most sensational. Now, I think audiences are a lot more, you know, they've grown up with this format. They're a lot more familiar with it. They're able to like suss out like how far they're supposed to suspend their disbelief. And reality shows have kind of like taken the place of the soap opera. So a lot of reality shows that are popular now are smaller. They're like more focused on human relationships and how we relate to each other, so that audiences can put themselves in those situations and be like, how would I react to this? Like, what would I do if my boyfriend Tom Sandoval cheated on me with my friend in my house when I wasn't there? I think it's the growth of the audience with the format and how familiar they are with it.
What were the critics saying at the time of Kid Nation's release? Like, how was it received critically?
I mean, it only had one season, so I feel like that says a lot. But a lot of people got concerned about whether they were violating child labor laws, whether, like, what conditions that the kids had been in. And then one of the things that I thought was interesting was the way that the kids were covered in the media. So there's a character who's a real person. Her name's Taylor. And her archetype is that she's a beauty queen from Texas. And she has this catchphrase, you know, like all good television has a catchphrase. And it's deal with it. And so like anything that happens, she's like, deal with it. And there was an article written by an adult calling her like a media whore. And she's like 8 years old, 9 years old, you know?
Oh my
and
God.
So I think that that also has a big part in the varied relationships that the former contestants have to the show, whether they look back on it fondly. It's like how media consumed it.
Okay, we should now move into your podcast picks. All good ones, all ones that I love myself. Okay, I have to say we have similar likes.
Okay.
So the first one that you chose was Today Explained from Vox. What is it about this show that you like?
So I love Today Explained because they do such a good job at getting you like excellent journalism, but they do it in such a relatable, engaging, thoughtful way. There's a lot of use of score and like sound design, and I love their theme song. I think it's great. Mm-hmm. And I just think that the two hosts do a really good job at like making sure that you're informed, but not doing it in a way that like sets off your nervous system.
Well, the clip we're going to hear from is their episode about Beyoncé's new country album, Cowboy Carter, and it's specifically around some of the racist backlash it got from people who think country music is only white music. Mm. In this episode, they spoke to the Black songwriter and author Alice Randall about country music's Black roots.
So after the Brown's Buckaroo in the 1940s, I want to jump forward until the late 60s and the early 70s and hit Charlie Pride. Charlie Pride is going to come out of the Negro Leagues baseball. He's going to rise. By 1971, he's going to be Entertainer of the Year country.
Whenever I chance to meet some old friends on the street, they wonder how does a man get to be this way.
He is going to come out as Black in the 60s in Detroit City.
Wait, what do you mean come out as Black?
When they released the early Charlie Pride
records. Oh, people didn't know.
My oldest sister used to say to me, why are you singing their music?
Okay. Their music.
Their music, okay. I said, well, it's my music too. Now, that's me growing up in a segregated southern state.
They actively made sure that no one knew he was Black. He, quote unquote, I am not saying this, sounds white. That's what it was said at the time. That he sounds white. What people thought was white, they did not put his face on the original. It did not share any photographs of him.
But some of them never learn it's a simple thing.
He wanted people to fall in love with the voice and the records first. And then he came out as Black in Detroit, Michigan when I was a little girl. I still remember people talking about it in the background of the city. And he will end up going to the top of the charts so many times. And so we get this line from Dee Fort Bailey to Charlie Pride. Both of them will belong to the Opry. Charlie will be given superstar status. He will become Entertainer of the Year. I believe that was in 1971. But at that same time, we get Linda Martell trying to step into that space, and she is shut down. She will be the first Black woman to sing at the Opry. She will release an album on Plantation Records, which is actually quite extraordinary.
I think I'll call him father. I think I'll call him love.
She's a beautiful voice. She's quite beautiful physically. She can rock these miniskirts. She has very much the sort of style of a Bobby Gentry and people who are superstars of the moment. The album, I believe, is called Color Me Country. One of the great singles on it is called Color Him Father, which is actually about a stepfather.
I love this man and I don't know why.
It's an extraordinary album, but she's on Hee Haw, she's on the Opry, but she never goes incognito. The very first time she comes out as a Black woman, there just isn't the traction. She experiences myriad micro and macro aggressions navigating Nashville. She is not allowed in this space.
Okay, Charlie Pride had done it. He had like broken the barrier. What happened with Linda Martell? Like, what was the resistance? He'd proved you could be popular and make money and be Black, so.
One of my favorite songs I've written is a song called Small Towns Are Smaller for Girls. And that was recorded by Holly Dunn. Small Towns Are Smaller for Girls. small towns are even smaller for Black girls. And that's what Linda Martell was up against, and Music City was a small town. Linda Martell, when she left Nashville, continued to make music. She just wasn't making it in country spaces. Now, in that time, in the early 60s, we're going to get the arguably most important album of country music, and certainly the most important album of Black country, perhaps to this current moment, is Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music by the great Ray Charles. I can't stop loving you. I've made up my mind. In my way of looking at it, D4 Bailey is the papa, Lil Hardin is the mama, and Charlie Pride is their genius child. This is the first family of Black country and the founding family of all country music. Because when Ray Charles releases Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music, it's going to deconstruct and reconstruct the industry and the audience's understanding of what country music is. And it's going to claim the first huge white and Black, Asian and Indigenous audience for country, because everybody listened to Ray Charles. He may not have been on the country charts, but everybody was listening to this. It was on the radios, it was in jukeboxes, it was everywhere, and it was constructing and deconstructing country music. Ray Charles is the foundation for everything, this genius child that's coming into this current moment. And this Beyoncé moment, and we now know that the album is called Cowboy Carter, is the biggest revelation since Modern Sounds in Country and Western. And it's that same kind of moment. I say that Beyoncé is Ray Charles's genius child. She is deconstructing and reconstructing country in her own aesthetic image, but reflecting the Black geniuses come before and larger country cultural genius, and creating new opportunities for genius to come after. To live
in me. From Vox, that was Today Explained. That episode was hosted by Noelle King, and the guest was Alice Randall. Their team includes Avishay Artsy, Amina Alsadi, Victoria Chamberlain, Anouk Dussault, Patrick Boyd, Amanda Llewellyn, and Jolie Myers. Up next is The Stoop. What can you tell us about this one?
I love The Stoop. The Stoop is hosted by Leela Day and Hannah Baba, and they tell stories from the African diaspora. So it's like stories rooted in Blackness, but like maybe from an angle you hadn't thought about before. And there's this episode that Leela did about the hair chart. And I remember the natural hair movement of like 2012 or what, when all of us were on YouTube learning how to do our hair and like basically having an apothecary in your apartment trying to figure out how to get perfect twist outs and stuff. And I just think that like sometimes when you think of things like a hair chart, like it can seem so
benign,
but also like fundamental, like it would have never occurred to me that it was something constructed, you know, that it was something that someone made and that that person could be fallible. Also didn't know that the person that made the hair chart was the person that did Oprah's hair. Did not know that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating episode. I also learned a lot listening to this. The hair typing system was created by Andre Walker. It puts hair into four categories, with one being the straightest and four being the kinkiest. Here's The Stoop with more.
What is your hair type? That has to be the like most frequently asked question.
4C hair is a beautiful creation, you feel me? And it's most beautiful when you take care of her.
The front portion of my hair is 3C. I'm gonna show you guys.
Andre's chart has gone way beyond his own line of hair care products. It's become the go-to way for many of us to understand and talk about the texture of our hair. But not everyone thinks Andre's categories are a good thing. But his chart has definitely got me thinking about the complicated relationship African Americans have with our hair. It's a complicated relationship that goes way back.
Okay, so Leela, we're about to go back. You are about to take us there. Let's just talk about what makes black hair so unique. Mm-hmm. So this is interesting. The shape of your follicle determines how curly your hair is.
Break it down, Dr. Baba.
So for coily hair like yours and mine, scientists say the texture of black hair creates like a natural air conditioning to protect us from the sun.
So our kinky coils are actually reflecting rays. It's a built-in cooling device. That's fascinating.
Yeah, they're reflecting rays and keeping moisture closer to your head. It's amazing.
I have an air conditioner on my head.
You do?
Okay.
It's a pretty air conditioning too.
So thank you. So that's something I'm going to get into right now.
Okay, carry on. We just had to stop because I never thought of that.
I know.
But take us back. Take us back to the story, Leela.
Okay, let's go back to the roots.
The roots.
Thick, kinky hair was considered a sign of health and wealth in parts of Africa. But in America, skin tone and hair texture was used to divide enslaved African people. Light skin and straighter hair could mean more privileges, like working in the house and not in the field. This idea of good hair and bad hair all developed during slavery.
This idea that the straighter your hair was or the closer it was to white textured hair, the better it was.
Ayanna Bird is the co-author of Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America. And she says the common belief back then was,
if you had straighter hair, you probably had more white blood than someone who didn't have straighter hair.
After slavery ended, these racist beauty standards hung on. In the early 1900s, some people tried to straighten their hair by putting oil on it and then wrapping it with heated flannel. Mothers were even wrapping their children's hair, often causing burns and a lot of hair damage.
There were even black churches in certain cities that would hang a comb on the front door. And if you couldn't comb your hair with that, then you couldn't worship at that church.
In the 1920s, hot combs were used to straighten hair. And then came a hairstyle known as the conch. You can see it on famous jazz musicians like Cab Calloway and Duke Ellington. The conch was the name of the style, but it was also the name of the relaxer itself, which was made with a harsh chemical called sodium hydroxide, or lye.
And it essentially just kind of ate away at your hair and at your scalp and caused a lot of serious burns, and they were not safe.
Some people made their own conchs, sometimes with two white potatoes, an egg, and Red Devil brand lye, a combo that left many scalps bleeding.
Ooh, that is harsh. But then, Leela, something started happening, right?
Yeah, so things started changing economically for black people. There became this emergence of a black middle class.
So black entrepreneurs saw the opportunity. Women were making money. People like Madam C.J. Walker, who created products like Madam Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower.
I could use some of that. Yeah, her face, C.J. Walker's face, was front and center on all these ads and all the packaging. Mm-hmm. She knew what she was doing. Mm-hmm. Then she recruited women and she trained them about the product and she sent them door to door selling her brand.
A boss. Yes. They earned a commission and Ms. Walker, she became a self-made millionaire. Go Ms. Walker. Mm-hmm. Pure power. She became a major philanthropist. She gave thousands to build up the community. But let's get back to the hair now.
The conch eventually went out of style, but relaxers made with sodium hydroxide continued on and became more and more popular. The wash and set and under the dryer with a magazine became a very common image in black salons. But then, in the 1960s, something different started rising.
We have come to register to vote, and you must realize that this is a national issue. It's not a Selma issue. It's not an Alabama issue. This is a national issue.
Whenever the civil rights movement brought on the beginning of a new shift that was all about embracing blackness. And this meant embracing your natural hair. My mom, aunties, they all did the big chop, cutting out the relaxers and wearing their afros loud and proud.
This brother here, myself, all of us were born with our hair like this, and we just wear it like this.
This is an interview from 1968 with former Black Panther Kathleen Cleaver.
So many, many years, we were told that only white people were beautiful. Only straight hair, light eyes, light skin was beautiful. And so Black women would try everything they could, straighten their hair, lighten their skin, to look as much like white women. But this has changed because Black people are aware, and white people are aware of it too, because white people now want natural wigs. They want wigs like this. Dig it? Isn't it beautiful? All right.
From PRX and Radiotopia, that was The Stoop. It's hosted by Hannah Baba and Leela Day.
I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
So up next is a podcast that you chose called Classy. What's that about?
Classy is a show that was created by Jonathan Menivar, who works with me at Pineapple Street. He explores our relationship with class and what it means to have class mobility. And I found this episode that he does because he used to work at Fresh Air. And the idea of creating a show about your relationship to class and then going to interview Terry Gross after creating your own show, I just felt like it was like this super interesting full circle moment that kept expanding. It was so interesting.
Okay, so let's take a listen then. This is Classy.
I don't know how much you know about my background at all.
Not that much, Jonathan.
So my parents were both immigrants. My dad's from El Salvador. I told her a kind of Cliff Notes version of where I come from. Parents divorced, factory jobs. Stepdaddy was a truck driver. And I went to college, but I went to a state school, and it was all mostly, like, working-class kids. Like, I even commuted there. I lived at home, you know? So, like, I think college is, like, such a place of transformation for people. Sounds like it was for you.
Definitely.
Like, a lot of that didn't happen for me in college. I was still, like, I was working full-time. But I think, like, the kind of transformation that happened really happened in work. And, like, and working for you was one of those, like, the first big step, you know? But the other part of it was that, like, Fresh Air was a big culture shock for me.
How so?
I just, like, I guess, like, the things that people were into and knew about were not things I knew about, you know? Like, I was not into musicals. I had not seen, like, all of Scorsese's movies. I kept this a secret from you, but I had never even seen The Godfather.
We would not have hired you had we known that.
I know how important that is to you and everybody else there. But I felt so scared, like, for the first, like, year and a half there. I just felt really out of place.
I didn't know that.
No?
No, I really didn't know that.
I guess I blended in well enough. She didn't notice. Why would she? I was new. I was learning. And I did a good job of blending in. Over time, I even became a little elite myself. I was hanging out with friends who had nice furniture and knew when asparagus was in season. One time, I showed up to a dinner party wearing a bow tie. But, you know, I didn't make all this up. In the beginning, I was out of place. I was uncomfortable. And it manifested in this weird contagion where I started laughing like her. Eventually, I had to tell her. You know how when you really enjoy something and you really laugh, you snort?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I caught your snort. I started laughing like you. Hillary was like, what are you doing? What is this thing? Like, where did this come from?
Oh, but that's probably because you had to listen to so much of my tape. It's so easy to pick up on things that you listen to all the time. It's like people, when I was first starting in radio and living in Buffalo, and I listened to the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Company, a lot, uh-huh. I started saying like a boot instead of about. Yeah, well, more or less, because I heard it so much. I mean, I think people just naturally pick up on sounds they hear a lot. So,
yeah.
But anyways, that's fascinating to me.
I think it's fascinating, too. And I think it does have something to do with this, like, class shifting that was happening in me and this, like discomfort that I felt, you know? That, like, I think I was, like, you know, looking to the people around me, trying to be like, how do I fit in? How do I be like them?
You know, can I just say, I so much, like, don't want to think of, like, class divisions within our show that I'm kind of trying to come up with all these other explanations like, well, of course you didn't care about Broadway. You're not from New York or even the East Coast. Well, mm-hmm. and you didn't see The Godfather. Oh, that's a generational thing. You didn't grow up with it. I saw it in a movie theater when it came out. And, you know, see what I'm doing? I'm trying to say, oh, no, it wasn't about class. It was about your geography, your age. You know what I'm saying? Because I don't want to feel bad about class divisions. So I think maybe I'm in a little denial about that.
Yeah. I don't know.
Alternate explanations.
Yeah. And those alternate explanations, are probably valid. I think it's a mix of all of these things, you know? But for me, I think, the class thing was a thing I was really feeling. We circled around this for a while. Sometimes I felt like I was standing on Jell-O. Like I must have just had this wrong the whole time. Sometimes the Jell-O melted and I felt more certain. More than anything, though, it doesn't feel good to have this kind of conversation. Bringing up this kind of class discomfort, there's a reason we usually don't do this. Once you start talking about it with someone, especially someone who was your boss, it starts to feel like an accusation. Like I was telling Terry it was her fault. I understand why she was looking for alternate explanations. But I know it's not just me. I'm not the only one who's taken on weird behaviors in the office. My editor Joel says that when he first started working in the magazine world, he looked down one day and he noticed he was walking like an editor he admired. Another person told me they subconsciously stole someone else's handwriting. I don't know, Terry. I don't think we're ever going to get to the bottom of this for sure, you know. But
I'm sure class was you know, I don't doubt class was a part of a lot of what you're saying. It's just that voice thing, I think.
Yeah.
I think people mirror each other all the time.
Yes.
In ways that are irrelevant to class, which isn't to say that there aren't times when they're relevant to class.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, there is, like, I talk differently than my parents talk, you know? And that may be because I mirror the people around me, but it has turned into a class thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So much so that sometimes there is, like, a little bit of disconnect of, like, trying to talk to each other, you know?
Right.
Because we don't exactly speak the same language.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Odyssey, that was Classy with Jonathan Menhever. Their team includes Kristen Torres, Marina Hanke, Asha Saluja, and Haley Howell. Okay, so next on your podcast list is Scam Goddess, one of my faves. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about this one?
I think The host of Scam Goddess, her name's Lacey Mosley. She is so talented. Like, she's hilarious. She can sing. She can act. I'm like, what can this girl not do? But also, I think if there was an award for best theme song in podcasting, it should go to Scam Goddess.
Okay, let's listen to a bit of it just so that people understand what you're talking about, because it is quite good.
Scam!
Like, if I were on RuPaul's Drag Race, that's what I would lip sync for my life to. Like, I just want someone to put, like, a bounce, New Orleans bounce beat behind it and hear,
yeah.
Like, it's just a bop. It's a bop.
It's good. It's good. And you don't often actually hear podcast theme music that's so specific to the show. Like, it's usually kind of just a bit of a wash. So, yeah, this one's great. So, in Scam Goddess, they have this episode that you suggested we listen to about Sean King, the infamous Sean King. For listeners who don't know who he is, can you explain who Sean King is?
He's someone who operates in these movement spaces around protesting and collective organizing. But there have been a lot of questions about the way that he moves and about him starting organizations, fundraising, and then the organization not being constructed, but the money is gone. Or just questions about, like, financial responsibility and whether he is, you know, who he says he is.
Yeah, it's quite something. I mean, one thing I will also add is a lot of people have accused Sean King of embezzling. Of
right.
embezzlement and taking money. So
right.
that is one of the core things about Sean King that connects him to, you know, the world of scamming. So let's listen to a bit of Scam Goddess. This is Lacey Mosley with her guest, Ashley Ray Harris, discussing Sean King.
So Red Record, which is a podcast that Sean launched, it appeared that he was subsuming this under the Justice Together brand as well as working on it separately.
Yes.
According to Ariel, he recruited a young Black organizer to assist him, then lied to her and removed her from the project and proceeded alone. And he used her ideas, but then discarded her. She writes yeah. about her experiences on Twitter. So if you want to find Ariel on Twitter, that's A-U-R-I-E-L-L-E. Yeah, like he was like, oh, I'm going to start a podcast. Hey, Black
yeah.
woman, help me out, queen.
All
right, queen, actually, get the f*** out. But I will
get
keep
out,
these
but
ideas.
I'm
going to
take your ideas. And that is something that, again, you see over and over again where people are like, hey, he said he was going to do this, like write this thing or write this book, but a lot of this is plagiarized. And a lot of this like article allegedly plagiarized. It's all allegedly taken, but you can see these women on Twitter, these Black women who went to Ferguson and worked with him, and mm-hmm. how their writing has these same ideas, and it's very clear this probably didn't just come from Sean.
Now here's my personal favorite.
Okay.
Ain't no mountain high.
Oh, it's my favorite too. Oh, it's
to
my
keep
favorite too.
Me from scamming you, babe.
Oh yeah.
Sean King said he was gonna climb 7 mountains on 7 continents.
Seven
of them things. In 2011, Sean began raising money to climb 7 mountains.
It was the Tell the Mountain to Move campaign. Which is just the audacity of that. Tell, I'm Sean King, and I'm gonna tell this mountain to move.
Now listen, in the Black church, we, Sean has done his research on Blackness, okay? Because Tell the Mountain to Move is the Blackest campaign I've ever heard
right.
from a church standpoint. I just, the audacity of this man. So he says he's going to climb 7 mountains, and he quit after how many days, Ashley?
Oh, he quit, I believe it was after 6 days.
You
actually,
say 6, I got 4.
Okay, so technically it wasn't even the start of the 7 mountain thing. So he went to a summit for training. And this is
right.
when he left the church. Like, this is what he left his church for. Like, these people
yes.
were like, you took our church away. You took our weekly praise away. And he was like, peace, deuces. I got to go climb seven mountains. But also, could you give me money to fly my family out so they could also enjoy these mountains with me?
To get flued out. He got his family flued out.
Got his family flued out. And so then he got there, and I think like with the family, and when he actually got to, he was like, they were all hanging out. He was like, now I'm going to go to this summit for training to prep myself, to get ready for this challenge, to do it. And it is in the training he only lasted 4 days.
And he writes about it in his book.
Yes. His book outlines it really beautifully. Like, it doesn't even try to hide the shame of it.
He was just like, we were doing these workouts, and like, you would have to like pretend that you were falling off of this cliff, and then like try to get your axe in the cliff so that you could practice falling off of a mountain. And he said he did it, and then it broke his everything and had to go to the hospital. And then he was like, you know what? Actually, after 4 days, I ain't gonna climb none of these mountains.
Yeah. And he said it also, like, he had some spinal stuff from, like, college, I guess, or, like, from...
Right.
I was like, so then why did you think climbing seven mountains would be a good fundraiser for you?
He said, I got spina bifida. I was like, Sean.
And it was
he
only...
didn't actually say that. I'm joking, yeah. But... What?
And when it was only Sean. When I was enrolled in mountaineering school that I realized that might be a problem, and maybe I bit off more than I could chew.
And the first mountain that he was supposed to climb, there are people on Twitter. If you go to Angry Black Lady on Twitter and you search Sean King, you'll find this thread where there were people on there that were like, I climbed that mountain in 6 hours with my family and I was 12. I was like,
Yes. That's the point, is that he, in the book, it's very, these were the most brutal mountains and brutal trainings you could ever do. And it's like, no, when you actually look, it's like a six-day program. For like middle schoolers and like adults, and you like take different ones just for anyone who wants to get into mountain climbing.
Sean, this was Runyon Canyon.
Right.
This was Griffith Park. He was like, I almost got to the observatory.
He was like, I didn't sign up to scam and have to work this hard. Like,
right. That's not why he scams. So Angry Black Lady on Twitter says, I literally can't get over the fact that Sean King raised thousands of dollars to climb seven mountains, including demanding people give him airline credits for his family so that they could fly to Seattle with him, and then quit after 4 days. 4 days. Boy, oh boy, do I love the mountain climbing. We're not even, guys, I got to get through these because we're getting close to the end of this episode. Life Goals University.
I love this one too. This one is good too. This one is such a OG scam.
College. Y'all, if we don't stop Sean King, he's going to be the next president. Like,
he's going to be president.
Donald Trump.
Like, he's going to be the next Trump. Like, all these white people are going to make this man president. He started a university online.
A university. In 2013, Sean charged people $49.99. And I'm sorry, I ain't going to no university with no 99 price point, okay? I don't want to go to $49.99 college.
No, 99
That's not,
college.
Okay? That sounds like them schools Lil Romeo be singing about. I don't want to go to college where they singing to me like, hey, if you want a degree, you gotta come here to university.
Like, you know, $49.99, like, your university is only advertising after 2 a.m. on Comedy Central. Like, it's
if
not
your university a- got a black man yelling at me, to my, get off your couch, you lazy ass! I don't want to go there. So he charged people $49.99 each to teach them about how to plan their lives. He did not follow through on these commitments, duh. And the comment page highlights issues people face. One of the comments says, grifter, always looking for your next set of victims. Damn. It, honestly, college should be $50. Sean is right about that. It should be
$50. It should be $50.
I'm sad that he didn't get people to college that they asked for.
Yeah, and you know, if it had succeeded, I maybe would have enrolled. I would like to learn to scam from Sean King. If he offered a class on that, I would honestly pay.
Sean King, if you ever start teaching robbery 101, we will be there.
From Earwolf, that was Scam Goddess. It's hosted by Lacey Mosley, and in that episode, she was joined by Ashley Ray Harris. Josh, that's all the time we have today.
It's over?
It's over. I know. I'm very sad about it. I really enjoyed having you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your podcast picks.
This is so much fun.
Josh Gwynn is the host of the new CBC podcast, Split Screen Kid Nation. You can find it on Spotify or your favorite podcast app.
Split Screen is a new feed we're launching here at CBC, and each season will feature a new pop culture deep dive. Everything we played today was chosen by Josh. If you liked it, you can find links and more info at cbc.ca/podcast playlist. Podcast playlist is Julian Uzielli and Ailey Yamamoto. Technical support from Laura Antonelli. Our senior producer is Kate Evans, and our executive producer is Cecil Fernandez. I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and I'm going to go watch some reality TV.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.